Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of August. We referenced yesterday's New York Times in preparation for today's first hour. Two leading senators said they were troubled by the FBI's collection of the phone records of four reporters at the Times and the Washington Post, and that the episode showed a pressing need for legislation pending in the Senate, it's already passed in the House, that would provide greater legal protection for journalists. Last week, the FBI disclosed to the papers that it had improperly obtained the phone records of reporters in their Indonesian bureaus in 2004 by using emergency records demands from the telephone providers as part of an investigation. The phone records were apparently obtained as part of a terrorism investigation, but the agency has not explained what it was investigating or why the reporters' phone records were considered relevant. We'll talk about a federal shield law, a media shield law, this hour of our program. And our guest is Lucy Dalglish. Lucy Dalglish is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, based in Washington, D.C. She has had that position since the year 2000, was a media lawyer for almost 5 years in the trial department of a Minneapolis law firm. She was a reporter and editor at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and she was she received her law degree from Yale, Bachelor of Arts in Journalism from the University of North Dakota, and was chair of SPJ's Society of Professional Journalists National Freedom of Information Committee from 92 until 95. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Those who are opposed to a media shield law, including the president, who said that he would veto such a bill if it were passed by the Senate, say that this bill would do more harm than good. It would adversely affect our ability to keep the country safe from terrorists and other criminals. What do you think? Our number again, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Or if you want to send us one of those emails, you can do that. And that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our guest again is Lucy Dalglish. Hello, Lucy. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Kathleen.
Tell me about the history of this. This has been something that the press has been interested in for quite some time, and Congress passed this by a huge margin, didn't they?
Well, yeah. The House passed it by a vote of 398-21.
Whoa!
Biggest majority so far this session. In fact, the biggest majority on any vote in a very long time. The issue itself is about as old as American journalism. If you ask any journalist who's been around for a while, they will tell you that they are taught that part of journalism culture in a democracy is to protect confidential sources if they feel that the only way they can get the story is to make that promise. And journalists will say it's just it's an ethical issue.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers and judges and people who are in charge of maintaining secret information don't view it as an ethical issue, but a legal one. And so we have been trying very, very hard to get a federal shield law for a long time. My organization was formed in 1970 over the issue of protecting confidential sources and preventing journalists from having to respond to a flood of subpoenas that had been issued back in the late 60s and early 70s by the Nixon and Johnson administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And we had maintained that we thought there was a constitutional right to not testify before federal grand juries. The U.S. Supreme Court said there was not on a very tight vote, very closest vote as you can get. But they said states and the federal government were free to come forward with statutes that protect the right of journalists to protect those sources. So in those years, we've managed to get protections in the states, in 49 states and the District of Columbia, the only state that does not afford some sort of protection by either statute or court decision or court rule is Wyoming. Apparently, it's not much of an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
But we have never been successful in persuading Congress that this was an issue. And to be honest, from about 1980 until about 2000, it wasn't that hot of an issue. The government in particular, the federal government, was not aggressively pursuing reporter sources.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2002, 2003, we have seen an incredible increase in the number of subpoenas issued by both federal prosecutors and civil litigants in the federal courts looking for the identities of confidential sources.
And is this terrorism investigation related, or are those the reasons given for this?
Some of them are terrorism related, but not. I mean, the great bulk of these subpoenas have nothing to do with terrorism or national security. Some of them, for example, were issued out in California on two San Francisco Chronicle reporters who had uncovered information about the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, BALCO. Those were the folks that were engaging in illegal substance use, providing those substances to professional athletes, most famously professional baseball players.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't have anything to do with national security.
Mm-hmm.
There was another reporter in Providence who had been working on stories about the prosecution of the mayor of Providence called Operation Plunderdome. The feds convicted Mayor Buddy Cianci, and after that thing was completely over, the courts, a federal judge decided he wanted to know who leaked one particular videotape to a reporter, a television reporter. And so those stories were very troubling. And they had nothing to do with terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just briefly about the story that I referenced in the New York Times, the senators saying they were troubled by the FBI collection of phone records of four reporters at the Times and the Washington Post. The agency is not obligated to explain what it was investigating or why the reporters' phone records were considered relevant?
Well, the agency is not required to explain when they do that to any of us. Here, maybe a little bit of background is useful. There are guidelines that the Justice Department has that they created years ago in the 70s about when they will pursue a subpoena asking for phone records involving journalists. They're supposed to go directly to the Attorney General himself or herself. Rule that says you can only keep the fact that you did that secret from the journalist for, I think it's 90 days, and then you have to send them a letter saying that you did that. Apparently, in this case, they did not follow that process, or they did not get the subpoena during that process, so that the reporters were just finding out about it now. I'm not familiar with a couple of those reporters, but I do know I have met Ray Bonner and Jane Perlez, his wife. Ray, in particular, has spent a lot of time since 9/11 and before 9/11 reporting from Africa and the Middle East, and they are off and on based there. And I know that Ray was working on a series of stories earlier in this decade coming out of Yemen. And I think they know that he's a very accomplished journalist, and he has a lot of sources, and they probably just wanted to know who he was talking to.
Right. Can you tell me, let's go to basics here. When is it necessary for, and why would a journalist rely on a source and have to keep that source confidential? Who would those sources be?
Typically, in most cases, those sources are whistleblowers, either in an agency or whistleblowers working for a company, people who have gone through the chain of command, decided something wrong was going on, they couldn't get attention to fix it, or they've seen a news story and believe that the public would benefit from knowing what was going on, and they come forward to the reporter, or the reporter goes to them, and they say, I'm sorry, I just can't talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I will lose my job.
Right.
I will be harassed. My life will be over. And the reporter says, well, this is very important. What if I promised you I would not identify you? And then they will say, okay, if you promise, okay, then I'll do it. Now, most of the time when this happens in a typical story, these folks are lower echelon folks. It does on occasion happen that these confidential sources are very masterful politicians who are trying to spin something. That does happen. I'm not going to deny that it doesn't. I'm not going to deny that it happens. But in my experience, that doesn't happen nearly as often as the folks who are saying, hey, look, if I tell you this and people find out that I'm the one who gave it to you, I'm really in trouble.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how many very, very large stories have been broken as a result of confidential stories. Watergate, of course, comes to mind right away. I think about the Iraq War and the number of CIA officials who came forward and had to, for reasons we understand, remain anonymous with information they had about whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction, what the reports were saying.
I think a more common example is one that I think your listeners are probably very familiar with. Ann Hall and Dana Priest from the Washington Post mm-hmm. relied on confidential sources when they were reporting about what I would consider to be mistreatment of our injured vets at Walter Reed Army
yes,
Hospital.
Yes, right.
I know for a fact, Dana's on my board, I know for a fact that those soldiers were afraid that if they found out that they were complaining or telling what was going on, they would lose their disability benefits, and their families would be bankrupted. And that was not a case of someone in an agency saying, oh, I'll lose my job, or I don't want them to know it's me. This was people who were concerned about how they were going to survive if word got out that they were revealing to these reporters some of the things that had happened to them at Walter Reed.
Mm-hmm. And so in order to get stories that are major stories that people's lives and their well-being depend on, there is a need for confidential sources.
Yes.
What about those who say that the Wall Street U.S. News and World Report had a commentary last week on this, saying that creating a new privilege for journalists would do more harm than good. Such a privilege would adversely affect our ability to keep the country safe, they say, from terrorists and other criminals.
Well, you know, that is an issue. That's a valid issue. And I think that in the language in both the House and the Senate bills, national security is appropriately and adequately addressed. The way those bills are drafted, and I won't go into the minutiae, they're slightly different. But essentially, if a prosecutor wants to subpoena a journalist for the identity of confidential sources, they have the opportunity to go to a judge and say, Your Honor, this is a matter of national security. The journalist privilege or the privilege of their sources to stay secret must be overridden in this case. In my experience, 99.5% of the time, a federal judge is going to defer to a U.S. attorney who comes in and says, I'm sorry, Your Honor, national security is implicated here. I know certainly mm-hmm. among my constituency, the reporters and the media companies that have been reviewing this legislation, I've just said, okay, we know we've lost national security. They utter the words national security. You know, the prosecutor is going to win. I think, however, this law would give judges the ability to make a decision of, okay, let's say national security is implicated, but what if the fact that this happened and the public's need to know that something happened completely outweighs the need to protect national security? In that case, we might still find out some of these cases. About these cases involving national security. I should also point out that the bill includes exceptions for journalists who are the only witnesses to a crime. It's not an absolute privilege. These are qualified privileges that a government or a private litigant will have the ability to persuade a judge that they really, really do need this information.
Mm-hmm.
I would never laugh at the government's argument that, you know, sometimes they really need this stuff. That's a serious concern, and I think this bill takes that into account.
Mm-hmm. Lucy, a lot has been made about a definition of a journalist, and some have said that the definition is so broad that it needs to be narrowed. Is that a legitimate question? Who is a journalist?
Well, I suppose it is. You know, when I go up on the Hill, some members of Congress say, I want to make sure that the new age of journalists are out there covered. This bill isn't broad enough. Then I go to somebody else's office and they say, oh, my God, this bill covers everybody. In my mind, I think both definitions in these bills are adequate. They do it a little bit differently. The House bill requires there to be some showing by the reporter that they maintain some form of livelihood or regularity, that they do this on a regular basis. I think that is workable. Quite honestly, the folks who are getting subpoenaed so far tend to be mainstream media, with people with really exceptional sources. The Senate bill does it a little bit differently. It follows current case law in the federal courts a little bit more closely. It does not require an income test. Rather, it looks at the function you were performing. And this is a test that I usually use when someone calls our hotline and asks for help. I look at the time they were gathering the information. Did they represent to their sources that they were doing a news story or a feature story or writing a nonfiction book? Did they gather this information with the intention of doing something to it editorially? In other words, telling a story. And did they all along intend to disseminate this information to an audience? When you use that technology-neutral test, I think you cover journalists. I say technology-neutral because it works for print, broadcast, internet. It kind of looks right through the technology. Because let's face it, there are some people out there who have so-called blogs. Some people are doing journalism and some people aren't. And it's kind of like that old phrase, I think it was from the late Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart when he was talking about obscenity. He said, I know it when I see it.
I know it when I see it, right.
And I think that's very true in this instance as well.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. Lucy Dalglish is Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. We're talking about a media shield law, and it has a version of it passed the House, as she said, just overwhelmingly, 398-21. It has not yet been brought to the floor in the Senate, which has a slightly different version, but the discussion about this is very much front and center with news last week concerning the New York Times and the Washington Post and their phone records of four of their reporters being sought by the FBI, possibly because they thought they had terrorism sources that the FBI needed to know about. So we're looking at the history of confidential sources and whether or not it's good for journalists to have a protection or if it's not good. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee. And if you would like to send an email, that is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have the second hour of our program this Wednesday. Ron Suskind will be joining us. He's written a marvelous book. He covers so much territory in it, The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. Ron Suskind joining us at 10 o'clock today. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050. If you're in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Lucy Dalglish is our guest, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And we start our calls with Jim from Salt Lake City. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Hey, I have one comment and two questions. I wonder, in a sense, if maybe the administration is doing this to stop leaks. And I read somewhere that our senator, Orrin Hatch, was supposedly a well-known leak. And I wonder if that's one way to stop people from sharing information. And then the two questions I have is, are cell phone records different? I understand the path they used to go to private investigators and get that information. And then the last question I have is with local law enforcement. Is it possible they could go to a local newspaper who's doing a local story and, you know, ask for those records?
All very good questions. And, yes, the administration is doing this partly to stop leaks. It's a very, you know, in some agencies, it's a very good tactic. You know, what a lot of us consider to be in the news business a whistleblower, someone in the White House is going to consider to be a leaker. So, yes, that is what they do. And, of course, what we've discovered, or what I've discovered after almost 30 years in journalism, is that the ship of state usually leaks from the top. And it's amazing how that works. Now, are cell phone records any different from regular phone records? No, they're not. They are allowed functionally, no. I think that the law, one of the things we're trying to do is clean that up a little bit. But no, cell phone records, you can also get access to those cell phone records, or you can try. And can a local prosecutor go in and subpoena a local news organization? You bet they can. In fact, the bulk of the subpoenas that are served on the media out there are served by local U.S. attorneys, and they are served on local reporters who are covering local stories. I tend to focus, I think, on the big national and international stories, partly because I'm sitting in Washington, and partly because a lot of the leaks in recent years, or a lot of the stories that have been done using anonymous sources, given this time of war and increase in terrorism, the flashier ones tend to, I think, come out of Washington. But as I mentioned, if you're in a small town, say you're in Salt Lake City, and the story the reporter covered ended up being prosecuted in state court, then state law would apply. And Utah just passed, the state Supreme Court just passed court rules that provide a reporter's privilege. So in Utah, if you were a reporter and the story you covered ended up in state court, you would have an outstanding chance of being able to get the subpoena quashed. But if that story you covered, and you have no way of knowing this, by the way, at the time you're covering the story, if the story you covered ended up being prosecuted in federal court, you have virtually no protection. And that's one of the reasons why 41 state attorneys general from around the country recently got together and wrote a letter to the U.S. Senate saying, please pass this bill. You're causing enormous confusion out there. We have, 49 of us have protections for reporters, and we can attest to the fact that we're still able to get justice accomplished. You need to pass this law.
Great. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Lines are open if you'd like to join us at 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. How would the Judith Miller, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson, other Bob Novak, other cast of characters from Time Magazine, et cetera, how would that story have changed if there had been a media shield law?
Well, I think the test done by the court, you know, there were 6 or 8 federal subpoenas that went out in connection with that case, and they all went out from U.S. District Court here in the District of Columbia. Some of those subpoenas had nothing to do with national security. I think they would have had a good chance of being quashed. You know, that's one of the cases where a judge would make that balancing test that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it would work. Some of them may have been quashed. Some of them may have not. But I think if you talk to Judy, and I have spoken to Judy Miller about this, she thinks that in her case, she would not have been successful in getting that subpoena quashed. Because she believes that, you know, the national security exception would have nabbed her.
The administration has said that media leaks have already undermined several programs, including the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. I can't remember who did that story.
I don't either.
Yeah, which vets foreign investment for national security concerns, and also the Terrorist Financing Tracking Program aimed at tracking terrorist-linked funds.
Well, they make that argument. I believe that if they were to investigate those leaks and if the release of that information was a crime and they were trying to identify someone, they would have the opportunity to go to the judge and say national security is implicated here and we think you need to uphold this subpoena. And I think they would have a very good chance of getting those subpoenas upheld.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the kind of lobbying. It seems to me as though most journalists, I mean the vast, vast majority of journalists and organizations, professional organizations representing journalists, have been on the Hill lobbying for this, and that you're pretty much united in your thoughts that there should be a media shield law.
You know, that's funny. One of the reasons I'm told back in the 70s, between 1973 and 1978, there were 99 separate shield laws introduced in Congress.
Oh, my gosh.
99. Everybody kind of agreed that something needed to be done, but they couldn't figure out how to do it. And the media organizations and individual reporters were all over the map. There were still reporters out there who said, you know what, we don't care what the Supreme Court says. I still have a constitutional right to protect this information. Then you had other media organizations that were saying, all right, we'll get a statute, we'll work for a statute, but we want it to be operational in all cases. Then you had other media organizations that said, you know, whatever we can get is fine. Congress ultimately said to us, look, when you guys can figure out with what you can live with, come on back. Well, then, as I mentioned, there were about 20 years or so where it wasn't that big of a problem, largely because the administrations that were in charge were not aggressively going after reporters. That all changed after 2001. And what also changed was we convened several meetings of media organizations, the nonprofits such as mine, the major media companies who have been paying millions, and I cannot say millions and millions of dollars, to defend against these subpoenas. The New York Times, I'm told, spent $2 million just on Judy Miller's subpoena.
Really?
This has become very expensive. So we've been meeting and negotiating. We have a conference call at least every other week. We're splitting up the duties, going up there. And I also want to make clear that individual reporters are not going up on the Hill talking about this. You probably understand. Anyone who's worked in journalism knows that the last thing a reporter wants to do is go up and ask a lawmaker for a special favor.
Mm-hmm.
and Congress, it's one of the difficult challenges is they keep saying, well, if you really want this, we want someone flashy to come up here and testify for it. Give us Brian Williams. Well, no working journalist right now, unless they're facing one of these subpoenas, is going to be willing to go up there and to testify before a body that they are going to be covering at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been very, very tricky. Ordinarily, when you're up there lobbying for a bill, you find somebody who's affected. Somebody, if you're campaigning for Alzheimer's funding, you're famous, you go up there and say, my mother has Alzheimer's. That's not what happens in this area. So just finding people who are in a position to go up there and talk has been very difficult. But I think we've managed to do it, and with all of these news organizations getting together and doing an enormous amount of compromising, I think we might pull it off this time.
And when do you expect to pull it off?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, we had a vote in the Senate. The Senate has a lot of very goofy, in my opinion, procedural rules. They had a vote to decide on whether or not to have a vote to vote. and it got caught up in the shenanigans surrounding the energy bill right before the recess.
Right.
There is still an opportunity for Senator Reid to bring this to the floor. But time is going to be tight, and in an election year particularly, as exciting an election year as we have in front of us right now, it's tough to get the Senate's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful we'll be able to get a vote. I know we have the votes to get it passed. President Bush has not come out and said specifically that he's going to veto it, but he hasn't said that he could live with it either. So what that means is we have to find probably 67 sure votes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. We go to John. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you doing today, ladies?
Fine. How are you?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just said I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm not in the middle of the woods, and so I pulled off to the side of the road. I'm a former editor with the Scripps Howard publication, and I am adamantly opposed to this. Actually, to be honest with you, it's one of the reasons I left the newspaper business is had a lot to do with this. And I'll tell you the reason why I feel that way. We're not talking about the Bob Woodruffs and these sort of people and your guests, but if you pass this law, then you're going to open up the floodgates for uncontrolled allegations by special interest groups. Forget the Washington Post, forget the New York Times, forget the Chicago Tribune. All of a sudden now you're giving the Star, the National Enquirer, political organizations are going to start publishing newspapers with biased, untrue statements. It is not a good thing. It is something, you know, we talk about the freedom of the press, and we assume that the freedom of the press also includes the confidentiality law. Well, that's not, I know the courts have ruled in those ways, but that's not the case. We have freedom of speech, but we also have limitations on freedom of speech. And I've always believed that we should never give the person concerned the ability to govern himself without any kind of regulations, especially when it comes to the press. As I said, that in one particular situation, the paper I was working for, I had a reporter come up, and it was regarding a local politician, and he quoted, I was concerned about his source, and I said, "Who is your source?" And he said, "My source is in the courthouse," and it turned out to be a janitor. And, you know, we just can't allow that. There has to be some control over something as powerful as the press. We just not going to allow people to say and do what they want uncontrolled. And like I say, for major papers such as the Washington Post, they do a very responsible job. However, there's a lot of newspapers and a lot of reporters out there who are not really white, who have their own special interests, and this would just allow them to create allegations. It would just flood the courts. And so anyway, I'd love to hear your response. I'm going to lose you on my cell. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Sure. Thanks for the call.
Well, that was really, there's a lot to chew on over there, and that's a very interesting perspective. Let me just, I jotted down some notes here. Let me point out that I agree that what the media and reporters are asking for is something special. But there are other people in society that we have granted these types of privileges to, doctors, mm-hmm. lawyers, clergymen, and there's nobody out there deciding who's a clergyman. We've decided that there's a value in our society in encouraging people to share information under certain circumstances. I believe that it is incumbent on journalists who are out there seeking this privilege to be humble about it and recognize that they're getting something that not everybody gets, that it makes them very uncomfortable, and it makes me uncomfortable too. But there are certain stories that can only be done with confidential sources. That said, I think the last several years when we've had so much public pushback about the use of confidential sources, there is not a single newsroom in America that I've had interaction with in the last 6 years that has not come forward with new policies on when they will tolerate anonymous sources. Everybody realizes that you have less credibility when you're using anonymous sources, and those sources must be used with great care. A lot of promises are being made these days that say, look, I will protect you, but if I get subpoenaed, I'm going to come back and ask you to release me from that promise, or I will protect you, but if I'm subpoenaed and it's a criminal prosecution, or if you lied to me, if I find out you lied to me, I'm going to, you know, reveal your identity. There are a lot of new deals being made out there. That said, sometimes you can only do these stories when you have the ability to promise confidentiality. Have we promised confidentiality too much in the past? You bet we have. And it's time to tighten up on that. And nobody should be out there as a loose cannon promising confidentiality. They should always, in my opinion, have to reveal to an editor who their source is and explain to their editor why they think that is a credible source. Now, on the final point that I'd like to make in response to what John said was about, you know, you're going to have chaos and all of these other people are going to be protected. I just don't think that's true. You know, as I mentioned, we have had shield laws. We have shield laws now in 36 states and the District of Columbia. We have common law privileges that have been recognized by the states in, let me do my math here, about 14 or 13 more states. Utah has court rules, and we have not seen that being misused. And certainly the National Enquirer and other folks like that have been afforded those privileges in the states over the years, and I just don't think, I think I disagree with him on that. But I do agree with him that we promise confidentiality too often, and we've gotten pushback from our readers and viewers. And I think most newsrooms are addressing that.
Mm-hmm. So what is the policy, and does it vary substantially from organization to organization, that reporters, if they're using a confidential source, must check with one editor or two editors?
It always varies a little bit, but in general, I'm not aware of anyone these days who does not require the reporter to share that information with an editor. You know, sometimes people who are very well-respected reporters, you know, might be given a little bit more leeway there. But let me give you the example of USA Today. When Ken Paulson came in as editor of USA Today, I think it was about 3 years ago. It was after the scandal they had where they had a reporter who was essentially making stuff up.
Right.
He came in and he said, anonymous sources you need special permission to use an anonymous source. And in the space of a year, he asked everybody on the staff, you know, calculated, they figured they reduced the number of anonymous sources used in the paper by 80%. He then went back to his staff and said, okay, what did we lose by reducing the number of anonymous sources? And it turns out that they don't think they lost any stories. Any flat-out stories, but they believe they lost a lot of context, a lot of verification. They lost something, but they did reduce the number of anonymous sources, and I think they are sticking with that policy and, trying to... I think that was a very interesting approach. Now, of course, the problem they had with their reporter... didn't have to do with the fact that he had anonymous sources. It had to do with the fact that he was making stuff up. So
right.
I don't think it was really a direct correlation, but it was an interesting response to that situation.
Yeah. More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the media shield law this hour of our program and welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you don't have access to a phone, feel free to use an email at talk@wpr.org. Lucy Dalglish is our guest, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Ron Susskind will be with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. His latest book is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. It concentrates on very personal stories of people who are trying to mend broken fences that exist among people all over the world. It is also filled with a lot of new information, some on anonymous sources, we must say, and some really breaking news that I never knew about. One of his revelations that Indian reservations have a large and growing radical Islamic community inside the large, varied Indian reservations that line the Canadian side of the long and porous U.S.-Canada border, and that it's created real tensions between Canada and the United States. It's a marvelous book. It's just filled with so much information, and he's a great writer. So that's the second hour of our program today. Lucy Dalglish, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, is with us now. Use an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org. David from Ironwood, Michigan is next. Hi, David.
Yes, I support the Shield Law, but I think a lot of people might not because they figure media is too powerful. I really do think that six corporations own most of the media in the world. It should be broken up. I would like to see a ban of corporations owning media. It should be individuals owning stock in media companies. And if you own more than 5% of the stock, you should have your name right on the news broadcast at the beginning of the news show. It's transparency so that people know, you know, if there is biases in the news and stuff, it will help show it. And if there was better Shield laws and better reporting, a lot of the stuff with the Bush administration probably would never have happened. I mean, the only way democracy can work is that the people need to find out what's going on. And if that's not happening, you know, our democracy hurts.
Lucy.
I agree, certainly agree with the latter part about, you know, we need more information getting to the people so that they can make the decisions they need to make at the ballot box. He's absolutely right about that. I know it's very interesting and very popular to declare that the media is way too powerful. I have to tell you, if you're talking to somebody right now who's in one of those newsrooms owned by a media conglomerate and they've just had their staffs whacked in half and they're not able to go out there and collect the news mm-hmm. and work in their communities, and I mean, I looked at I was back in Minneapolis a few weeks ago, and I just picked up a Star Tribune in the airport, and I was shocked at how light it was compared to what it was when I was living there. You know, there has been pushback to this consolidation of the media. A lot of, for example, when Knight Ridder was bought up by McClatchy, then the first thing McClatchy did was split it up, and what used to be one company is now split up into about eight different ownership scenarios. And that's a function of the stock market. And that's just a function, I guess, of capitalism and people wanting to make more money off of these companies. We're involved in a very, very interesting time right now. But I do know that in the past, not right now because these companies are not making enough money and they're having to lay off lots of people, but in the past, when there was some corporate ownership of some of these news organizations, they were able to cover the news in ways they were never able to do before. And, of course, we're also seeing a lot more citizen-style media out there.
Right.
I guess that's sort of the name of the game these days. A lot of neighborhoods are getting together and communicating with each other because they can no longer get the information they need from their local newspaper, and I find that very troubling because mm-hmm. I think there is a certain value in having someone who is trained to gather and interpret the news produce it for a news consumer. So I think we've seen a lot of bust-ups involving some of these companies. The Tribune Company is an example. They just sold off what used to be an outstanding newspaper on Long Island called Newsday. Which is now owned by a small cable company. These are very, very interesting times.
Mm-hmm. And you look at somebody like Susskind, who's coming on later. I can't tell you how often during the course of reading his book, I thought, whew, this should have been a major story that we knew about at the time that it was happening. And I couldn't figure out if we didn't have enterprising reporters or if they were worried that they would get nabbed for printing some of these stories because some of the sources are anonymous. But huge stories, Lucy, that never really saw much of the light of the day in America.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But you know what? You can never keep up on all of the stories that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. And I think we are seeing now, the stuff that Susskind reports on, and he does an amazing job, but there are probably thousands of other stories out there as well that need to be
right.
reported on.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob from Madison next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I was working at a very large employer, and I kind of have a different view from when you had a caller 10 minutes ago who did not want the Shield Law. I had, at a very large employer, enough evidence to sink the Queen Mary, if not that, put a dent in the side of it, and it would be super critical to me. I mean, this was hard evidence. It wasn't, you know, my account versus somebody else's account. This is actual documents, et cetera. And so it was just super critical to me. It involved, like, I was accused of being a lazy worker. I had efficiency reports showing that I was 25 and 50% ahead of my fellow workers, et cetera. I simply had, it was old age discrimination. They systematically took the salaried people and the wage earners and the union people and the committee people, wrote them up. And in order to, I saw it as taking the efficient workers, running them out of the plant, installing the lower motivated workers to work, then they had a rationale to outsource. Just all this stuff was outsourced overseas. They had a rationale. The faster workers were run out, the older workers, the gray-haired older people, and both salaried and wage earners. That's my only comment. I'm blacklisted from ever working again, just for threatening to go to a government agency, not for going to a government agency with my documents, just for threatening my going up the chain of command at disciplinary meetings and telling them that I would go to a government agency. I'll never, even though I'm a spotless clean, no criminal record, no nothing, you know. Okay, I'll let you go. Bye.
Okay,
all right,
you.
Goodbye. And what if you'd gone to the press with that story?
Well, they would have, I'm sure they would have investigated it, and if they found something that was inappropriate or illegal or an interesting economic story. I think the angle of, you know, how do you weed people out so that you can outsource and save some money? That's a very, very interesting business desk story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he might be right about that. And I think I personally would find it very interesting to read a story or watch a story that kind of took apart an entire scenario like that. Why are our jobs being outsourced? This is how you accomplish it.
Right.
I would find that to be a fascinating story.
I would, too. Yeah. So you should have gone to the press.
Well, you know, that is one scenario. I don't know the
right.
circumstances.
Right.
But, yes, that is certainly one option he might have had.
Right. Well, so you think in the overall, when you look at the history of the press of the United States, things in terms of trying to get reporters' sources, attacks against confidential sources, is as bad as it ever has been, Lucy?
Yeah, I think it is.
Do you?
I really do. And particularly in the federal courts, we've really come a long way in the state courts. We don't see nearly as many mm-hmm. state court subpoenas as we used to, because now states have laws in place that, you know, in your own individual state, you have a pretty good idea of how it works. On the federal side, you know, it's not just prosecutors coming after you. There are also scenarios, people who are former federal government employees who have information held in their personnel records, and they are the subject of unfavorable or intrusive media coverage, they can bring a lawsuit under something called the Privacy Act. And we've seen several stories, one brought by Stephen Hatfield, a government scientist who was a suspect in the anthrax case, We saw Win Ho Lee, who actually pled guilty to a felony down in New Mexico for mishandling nuclear secrets. Linda Tripp, remember her from the Monica Lewinsky debacle?
Right? Yeah.
She sued under the Privacy Act when somebody shared the information that she was looking for another government job within the Pentagon. They said that that was information in their personnel records that should not have been shared, and they sued the government for millions and millions and millions of dollars. Now, to prove that allegation, they had to show that the leak came from an executive branch agency, and courts ruled that they couldn't just say that the information, if the reporters were not allowed to say, yeah, it came from the Justice Department or whatever. They wanted to know who the specific leaker was.
Hmm.
So more than half of the subpoenas we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years have come in civil cases.
Mm-hmm. And, we have to say goodbye at that note. Lucy, thank you so much. What an interesting hour. We'll talk to you again.
It was very enjoyable. Thank you,
Kathleen. Thank you. Lucy Dalglish, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Thanks to Jonathan Anderson for producing this hour and to Jonathan Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Please stay tuned. We have a very interesting hour ahead. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.